Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll talk with University of Utah Law Professor Amos Giora. We'll talk about his latest book, The Complicity of Silence, Confronting Ecosystems of Child Sexual Abuse in Schools. We'll also talk about the Bystander Initiative, as well as the current situation in Israel, Gaza, and Lebanon. In November 1997, 12-year-old Jeremy Bell was killed at the hands of Edgar Friedrichs, a serial pedophile, teacher, and later principal, who taught for decades at Pennsylvania and West Virginia schools, despite extensive complaints submitted to school administrators. In the book, Professor Giora analyzes the case with the assistance of the extraordinary documentation of Dan Barber, the private investigator who solved it. We're going to talk about this case, what it means, following the news. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today, my guest for the hour is University of Utah Law Professor Amos Giora. We're going to talk about his latest book, The Complicity of Silence, Confronting Ecosystems of Child Sexual Abuse in Schools. We'll also talk about the Bystander Initiative, as well as the current situation in Israel, Gaza, and Lebanon. In November of 1997, 12-year-old Jeremy Bell was killed at the hands of Edgar Friedrichs, a serial pedophile teacher and later principal who taught for decades at Pennsylvania West Virginia schools, despite extensive complaints submitted to school administrators. In the book, Professor Giora analyzes the case with the assistance of extraordinary documentation of Dan Barber, a private investigator who solved it. And as an expert in the power systems that allow the worst criminal behavior to fester unobstructed, Professor Giora uses specific facts of the Bell case to demonstrate how a network of enablers and bystanders allowed a proven predator to remain free and access children at several schools from 1975 to 2001. Professor Giora is advocating for broader policy changes and social safeguards necessary to prevent such disasters from occurring in the future. Amos Giora, thanks for joining us again on Access Utah.
Thanks so much for having me. Pleasure to be.
Extraordinary book. We'll get into to that. I want to, since you're a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen, a split time between U.S. and Israel, I want to talk just briefly, 10 minutes or so here at the beginning, about the situation in the Middle East. What are your friends and family saying from, that I'm sure you keep in contact about escalation of conflict now into Lebanon?
So I just got back to Salt Lake City on Sunday. I was home for 2 weeks for the Jewish high holidays. I obviously spent time with family and friends. I think I want to be careful because I can only speak for myself, but I think for people of my political ilk in Israel, I would say that more than anything, there's a sense of endlessness, relentlessness, lack of any articulable strategy. But as much as we can talk about Lebanon and, quote unquote, happy to talk about Lebanon, for me, the primary issue are the 101 hostages still held by Hamas. And from my perspective, the determined decision by Prime Minister Netanyahu for his own political survival to, in essence, abandon them. I put in parentheses, Tom, I'm actually writing a new book addressing this issue in part, in addition to other issues within Israel. But for me, the Lebanon is a serious concern. The fact that either last week or 2 weeks ago, two Israeli soldiers were killed by a rocket fired from Iraq. The fact that 2 weeks ago, yesterday, I spent the evening in a bomb shelter with my granddaughters and my son-in-law because of the attack from Iran. Obviously, attacks also on and off from Syria, Lebanon. But at the end of the day, take all of this, all significant, all important, all deeply troubling. But we can never take our eyes off, for me, what is the most important issue, and that is the hostages held by Hamas.
So you're saying the prime minister is essentially abandoning them. Do you mean by that he's not making them a priority, and there's really no end in sight for a peace agreement in Gaza that would bring the hostages back?
Well, yeah, I think that's exactly right. Netanyahu's for purposes of his political survival, in terms of the complicated mathematics of the Israeli parliamentary system and his present government coalition, understands that release of the hostages goes hand in hand with the ceasefire. But he also understands there are two extreme parties in the government that have consistently threatened him that if he were to go forward with a ceasefire / hostage deal, that they would leave the government. And you don't have to be a mathematical expert to understand that were those two parties to leave the government, then the government would fall. There'd be a vote of no confidence. And then, you know, with elections, you never know how elections would turn out. And so for him being Netanyahu, who's solely and exclusively focused on his political survival, it's the only thing that interests him. A hostage deal does not serve his purposes. And it's the reason that the hostage families have, I think, come to that realization that they have been abandoned by the prime minister. And that's why there's been an uptick in terms of the language of in the demonstrations. I went the same day of the firing from Iran. I think it was the 7th of October, maybe it was last week, last Tuesday, I went to a gathering of hostage families honoring the anniversary of the 7th of October. There's a real sense on their part that indeed the government, I mean Netanyahu, has abandoned them. But because we're also talking about enablers, as I write in this forthcoming book, Netanyahu is able to abandon them because he's protected by the enablers in the government and others who protect him for their own purposes. But from the hostage perspective, the combination of Netanyahu and the enablers in many ways leaves the hostages to a fate that I think is increasingly clear to many, if not all of us.
So protests do continue then?
There will be the Jewish holiday begins tonight in Israel tonight. But yes, in spite of the Jewish holiday, there will be protests in Tel Aviv on Saturday night. And for some people, one needs to be honest, it's difficult to demonstrate while soldiers are in harm's way in Lebanon. For some people, that is hard. And also, in terms of numbers, there are a significant number of people who've been called up to reserve duty. So perhaps there are less people demonstrating. I also think, again, this is Netanyahu's success, in air quote success. He has normalized the situation of the hostages. And by being able to normalize it, there's real concern on the part of the hostage families that I think that they feel that the public has been normalized, or the situation has been normalized. And that, I think, from their perspective, is a source of concern in terms of numbers of participants in the demonstrations. That said, when I went last Tuesday in Jerusalem, there were a lot of people. There was also a memorial service, not a memorial service, an event, let me hear the language, that night, and there were thousands upon thousands of people observing on screens because it was a virtual event. But again, it's important to note that if you have a prime minister who is focused on his survival exclusively and enabled by those who enabled him, the fate of the hostages is a source of deep, 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 deep concern. And in the meantime, you're right, that there is fighting going on in Lebanon. Today's Wednesday, and on Sunday, Monday, four soldiers were killed. I think one was killed either yesterday or Monday. I mean, it's ongoing and constant. We're all waiting to see what will be the Israeli response to the Iranian attack of 2 weeks ago yesterday.
So what, for Gaza, I guess, for Lebanon as well, what's the end here? How does this end?
I think one of the realities is there's an excellent article in our leading newspaper, Haaretz, would be the equivalent of the New York Times, I think yesterday, that there is no answer to your outstanding question, because Netanyahu understands that his political survival is, never say use the word guaranteed, but is enhanced by continuous war, because that bolsters the base or amps up the base. I don't see any strategy with respect to Hamas or with respect to Hezbollah. Netanyahu, after October the 7th, the mantra was together we will win. I have no idea what that means. I have no idea what victory means. And that is, I mean, the mantra, victory, victory, is illusory at best. But you see it on signs on the highway. You see it on bumper stickers on cars, victory, victory, but I have no idea what it means. And the idea of defeating Hamas is, as I think you know, I served as a legal advisor of the Gaza Strip. I've interacted with people from Hamas. The idea of defeating Hamas is again, in polite English, is an utter illusion. It's a dangerous illusion. And with respect to Hezbollah, so was it 2 or 3 weeks ago, the blowing up of the beepers, and 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, I'm sorry, I don't remember the date, the killing of the head of Hezbollah, Nasrallah, and then in the last X days, killing more and more Hezbollah leaders, but maybe even having wiped out the top tier of Hezbollah fighters. That's fine. Sorry, of Hezbollah leaders. That's all great. On the other hand, they're continuing to fire hundreds of rockets into Israel and drones on a daily basis. So you can kill Nasrallah, you can kill all these other guys, but that doesn't mean that, you know, victory is at hand or victory is near. There is that consistent theme of victory, victory, but that is simply a mantra which is beyond dangerous because there is no sense whatsoever of anything happening in the context of victory.
So you reference those protests being ongoing for quite a while. I think anti-government protests and anti-Netanyahu. But I guess my question is, the folks protesting, what do they want?
We want three things. Someone who has been very, very, very active in the protests, and also willing to assume the discomfort of pretty significant verbal violence, which is one it hears often at these demonstrations. So the first round of demonstrations, I take it back historically, what was called the Balfour demonstrations, Balfour is the street where the prime minister lived, was to get rid of Netanyahu. We succeeded because there was a change government. And then when he came back and then he started with the judicial reform, the next round of demonstrations were against the judicial reform, which is reform is an air quotes, it's a polite term for the evisceration of democracy, and the evisceration of the rule of law. And we were successful there because there were hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds, thousands of us demonstrating every Saturday night. By relative numbers, it's something like 20 million Americans every Saturday night taking to the streets. That's a lot. Saturday after Saturday after Saturday after Saturday. Then after October 7th, there was the word in English would be a lull in the demonstrations because it took a while to, obviously, because of October 7th. The demonstrations now call for the release of the hostages / ceasefire. So we've gone from getting rid of Netanyahu, succeeded, judicial reform, we succeeded. Again, we'll see if the government reinitiates the judicial reform, and the demonstrations now are focused exclusively on ceasefire and the release of the hostages.
I assume these protests will continue into the future.
I would absolutely assume so, because I think there's an understanding that again, you know, in the world of enablers and bystanders, sitting in your living room and bemoaning the current situation doesn't lead to anything. But I want to emphasize, I know this is hard for American audiences to understand. When I went to a gathering on behalf of the hostages in August, there was a counter demonstration of people opposing a hostage deal. And I don't know if you've ever been to Israel, but anybody who's been to Israel knows that we're not a kumbaya culture. There's no political correctness whatsoever. And there is, I think the correct term in English, there is verbal violence. I mean, it which is not pleasant to hear, but it is what it is. And it's part of the Israeli culture, but there are counter-demonstrators, absolutely, who are opposed to the hostage deal because they would view a ceasefire as surrendering to Hamas.
Mm-hmm.
More than that, some of the hostage families have been the recipients of death threats, and at least one woman who was a hostage who was released when she has demonstrated in favor of a hostage deal has been physically attacked.
Are people worried about even further escalation of conflict, of violence here?
Amongst ourselves or with Hamas and Hezbollah?
Hamas, Hezbollah, yeah.
Well, first of all, with Hamas, there is no war in Gaza. It's a stalemate. We fire, they fire, they fire, we fire, and soldiers are dying, and obviously Gazans are suffering. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. It's not a war. Is a conflict in Lebanon warlike? I think that's fair to state. But again, I remind you that war, you know, traditionally articulated in international law, is interaction between the state actor. Hezbollah is a non-state actor, obviously supported heavily by Iran. But the conflict in Gaza at the moment is warlike. But again, from both sides, I mean, obviously Israel's attacking into Lebanon, firing into Beirut, attacking Hezbollah fighters, absolutely, killing Hezbollah leadership in the same way that Hezbollah is firing the drones and the rockets and the missiles into Israel on a constant basis. And all that while waiting for the response to how Israel will respond to the Iranian attack of 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess finally on this, then we'll take a break and get into talking about the book and the Bystander Initiative. What should the U.S. do?
So it's complicated because, as I understand it, there's an American election in 3 weeks. And how that plays into this, you probably have a much better handle on it than I do. Yesterday, President Biden announced that the United States will send to Israel some kind of an anti-missile infrastructure, including 100 American soldiers. I think that from the perspective of Prime Minister Netanyahu, there's no doubt, again, from his perspective, he would far prefer that Trump will be reelected. I think it's very clear that Vice President Harris has a very different relationship with Netanyahu than Trump has had with Netanyahu. It's very clear that Biden has lost all patience with Netanyahu. One only has to read excerpts from Bob Woodward's newest book to understand that. And I think that Vice President Harris has, not only a cool relationship with Netanyahu, I don't know enough about her relationship with Israel. It's clearly different from Biden's. One needs to say it's important to state that Biden is the last American president who will have any true emotional interaction, understanding of the Holocaust. That has dictated much of how he's interacted with Israelis. But he, like Clinton and Obama, had a very, very complicated, probably contentious, perhaps even cold relationship with Netanyahu. Trump's relationship with Netanyahu has had ups and downs. It probably depends on the day. But in terms of the United States, and I think, you know, Biden tried to be very involved in the hostage deal, truth be told, didn't succeed. And I think when he really, really became angry with Netanyahu is that it was in July, May or July, depends who you want to believe, there was a deal literally all but done. And at the last moment, Netanyahu included or incorporated last-minute changes into the deal that had been agreed upon, which is why in that conversation between the two of them, Biden said to him, "Don't boop 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 me." I leave it to your audience to understand what he said to him, which is, I assume, also the reason that in the words of the book, but Biden is quoted as saying, "Of Netanyahu's 18 advisors, only one speaks the truth." And I think that tells you a lot about it, that he does not really, I think, understand how to interact with Netanyahu, and I think that's a significant problem.
Well, much more we could say, but I want to get on to talking about the book and the Bystander Initiative. We're talking with University of Utah Law Professor Amos Giora. He is a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen and splits his time between Utah and Jerusalem. And so we always want to get his perspective on this. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking about Professor Giora's new book. It's called The Complicity of Silence, Confronting Ecosystems of Child Sexual Abuse in Schools. More following this. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're talking with University of Utah Law Professor Amos Giora. The upcoming book is The Complicity of Silence, Confronting Ecosystems of Child Sexual Abuse in Schools. We also want to talk about the Bystander Initiative. And as we post this program, we'll have links to those, to the book and the Bystander Initiative on our website, upr.org. So, Professor Giora, you say in your introduction to the book, I'll just read this, by way of introducing myself to the reader and how it is I became so deeply engaged in the 1997 murder of a 12-year-old boy in West Virginia. A brief synopsis might be helpful. I'd love to have you take us briefly through that, how you got involved in this whole field.
Utterly by unintended. When I came to American academia 20 years ago, after having served for 20 years in the Israel Defense Forces, the first 10 years that I was in American academia, my writings were primarily, but not exclusively, on terrorism, counterterrorism. While training for the Salt Lake Marathon, my running partner, who's not Jewish, we were in the middle of one of those awful 20-mile runs in the avenues in Salt Lake, just said to me, how did this happen? And even though both my parents were Holocaust survivors, I grew up in a home where the Holocaust was never mentioned. There were no books about the Holocaust. I knew nothing about my parents or about their Holocaust experiences. And so when she asked me, how did this happen, I had a brilliant answer, which was, I have no idea. I'm 67 now, and I was 10 years ago, and I said, you know, enough is enough. And so I started reading a lot about the Holocaust. But there was one area that was clear to me had never been addressed, and that was the bystander, particularly from the perspective of the legal responsibility of the bystander. There have been two great books written about the bystander, one from a historical perspective and one from a sociological perspective, but never from a legal perspective. So I wrote the book called Crime of Complicity, The Bystander and the Holocaust. Then I thought I was done with it. I mean, it was fine. It was interesting. But then I wrote a book called Armies of Enablers, which was about enablers at, who enabled sexual assaults at Michigan State, Penn State, Ohio State, Catholic Church, and USA Gymnastics. And I thought I was done with this. And then I was introduced, long story, but I was introduced to the private detective, Mr. Dan Barber, who is in many ways the hero, because he's the one who made his way to West Virginia, where he solved the murder of the boy, which we'll talk about. And what's important there is, we're happy to discuss this, is that local law enforcement closed the case within a day or two, saying that the boy, 12-year-old Jeremy Bell, died of a weak heart or some unfortunate medical tragedy, which is 100% incorrect. And Mr. Barber left his home in Erie, Pennsylvania, and went to live in West Virginia for 2 to 3 years. And step by step by step by step, initially by himself and then with a couple of people who were working with him, broke the case as a result of the murderer. Edgar Friedrichs is in jail for the rest of his life, which is fine. But that's not the issue. The issue is, how is it that Friedrichs, who was a teacher and principal, was able to, for 30 years, be a serial predator, pedophile, initially in Philadelphia, and then when he was not fired, but was reaching an agreement with the principal in Philadelphia that he would leave the school, and then he moved to West Virginia, and then every time there was complaints, more complaints, the school administrators would simply move him from school to school in the same school district. Those are the enablers.
I want to read this. This is from your introduction. You talk about interviewing. You've interviewed many survivors of sexual assault. You say, for many of the sexual assault survivors I've interacted with, their primary, albeit not exclusive, anger is directed not at their assailant, but rather at those who could have prevented it. That's a big part of what you're talking about here.
100%. And when you do reverse engineering with survivors or victims, because I want to be called survivors, I want to be called victims. I obviously respect however they want to be referred to. They have this "oh my gosh" moment when they realize that they never should have had any interaction with the predator. Edgar Friedrichs never ever should have been teaching. Edgar Friedrichs never should have had the opportunity to teach Jeremy Bell, because when you reverse engineer it, and I'm looking at the 15,000 pages of documents in my office that Mr. Barber bequeathed to me. We found in those documents a handwritten letter of recommendation written by the first principal in Philadelphia, where this was the first documented case where there were three boys in one family who he had abused. There was going to be a court case, but for very complicated and uncertain reasons, that case never came to fruition. But the teacher writes him a handwritten letter of recommendation, wishing him the best in his future, blah, 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 blah. So he left that school. He opened up a clothing store right next for men, right next to an elementary school, things you can't make up. And then he moved to West Virginia. But he came with that handwritten letter of recommendation by the principal of the school where he had abused three boys. So that's the initial enabler. And then once he got to West Virginia and the complaint started, that ultimately resulting in Jeremy's murder, when you reverse engineer it, he never should have been in West Virginia, or at least never should have been teaching in West Virginia, and certainly should never have been able to go from school to school every time there were complaints.
Let's pause here and define bystander and enabler. Two different things, you know, both bad and can help these horrible things continue. Define bystander and enabler.
So there's a difference. The bystander is physically present when harm occurs. So let's say you're walking down the street and you trip and fall, and people see you trip and fall and see that you're in distress. There are bystanders. And there's legislation in Utah, thanks to Representative Brian King running for governor and Senator Bramble, that expanded mandatory reporting to impose on you the one requirement only, and that is to dial 911. There's no obligation to actually do anything. So the bystander is physically present. The enabler is not present, but the enabler knows or should know of harm. So with respect to Jeremy Bell, the school administrators who were receiving the complaints and then in the vernacular were fobbing off the parents and complainants, those are enablers. So the previous book, The Armies of Enablers, when I again looked at Michigan State, Penn State, Ohio State, and the other institutions, the enablers, coaches, trainers, doctors knew of the harm but made the conscious decision to ignore the harm, protect the institution directly, indirectly protect the perpetrator, and directly contribute to extraordinary harm, which is why, you know, from a one-person bandwagon, which was also about the bystander initiative, which we can obviously discuss, the whole point of this entire enormous undertaking is to work with legislators in Utah, the United States, and internationally to criminalize the enabler, and that because that, for me, is the only way to hold them accountable.
So one of your colleagues coined a term, the ecosystem of enablers. Tell me about that.
So that was a student, one of the research assistants under the auspices of the Bystander Initiative. When we started looking at the Jeremy Bell case, she said it's an ecosystem, that it's indeed exactly that. It's an ecosystem whose primary function in an institutional context, in the context of institutional complicity, is to protect the institution directly, indirectly the perpetrator, and directly thereby lead to harm to the survivor victim. But it really is an ecosystem because it's deliberate. There's nothing here that happens, oh my gosh, you know, I didn't understand. That's just incorrect. It's important to understand that the enablers, again, regardless of the institution, it's the pattern that repeats itself time after time, where it's the exact same, same ecosystem, the same DNA that functions the exact same way, that every time someone comes forward to complain, they are, to be polite, dismissed and ignored, and thereby accentuating the extraordinary harm.
And you write in the book that this ecosystem illustrates a fact that there's a whole institution usually, right? And enablers are protecting the institution. They're on one side. On the other side is an individual, right? The survivor.
100%. So the survivor, so the title of the previous book, Armies of Enablers, that, by the way, didn't come from me. It came from a woman named Lindsay Lemke, who was the captain of Michigan State University's women's gymnastics team. I kept talking about enabler, singular. And at some point, Ms. Lemke lost her patience with me, correctly so. She said to me, Giora, it's not enabler, it's enablers. It's armies. She said, wherever I turn, because she was abused by Larry Nassar, the doctor, who was also the doctor of USA Gymnastics, wherever I went to complain, there were armies of enablers protecting him, protecting Michigan State directly, protecting Nassar indirectly, and again, facilitating, accentuating her harm. And it's that same pattern of wherever a survivor sought to go, the institution directly, perpetrator indirectly, protected by the armies.
So why do the enablers do it? Is it the focus on the institution? They want to protect the institution?
I think there are probably four or five different reasons. One, for some enablers, I think their loyalty is to the institution. Two, I don't think most people don't like being the so-called whistleblower. I think some people understand that their financial welfare, safety, well-being is to be affiliated with an institution rather than a survivor. Some people are, frankly, apathetic. When I interviewed Jamie Dancher, who won the bronze medal in gymnastics in the Olympics, and I asked her the question you just posed, she said that elite athletes, and these are, Olympic athletes are obviously elite athletes, her words, not my words, we're not particularly likable. The world revolves around us, and we're not sympathetic. And in that, from her perspective, that is one of the reasons that the enablers of NASA in the Olympic community simply didn't like them. Didn't like them, the survivors. We're not in any way sympathetic to them. In the case of Edgar Friedrichs, the school administrators who protected the schools in West Virginia, they didn't know Jeremy Bell because he was just another boy in the class. Were they interested in protecting the good name of the school? Could be. Were they interested in quieting the waters? Could be. Did they not want a headline in the newspaper? Could be. But I also need to add, and I wrote this in the book, if Mr. Barber were with us, he would suggest to you, but I can't prove it. And I emphasize, I'm sharing Mr. Barber's theory, which I cannot prove, and therefore it's it's an argument that he would make, is that some of the enablers perhaps have skin in the game, that perhaps they themselves are. But because I can't prove that under any condition, I can't write it.
Mm-hmm. So this goes beyond, as you recount in the book, it goes beyond the school administrators, fellow teachers, etc. The police investigation, the original DA, as you write, the policeman investigating the death of Jeremy Bell seemed to be purposely ignoring some pretty obvious evidence, or at least that's one interpretation you could give to it.
He is murdered on the night between Thursday and Friday. There are three people in the cabin. It's Friedrich's cabin. There are two boys, Jeremy and another boy, who's anonymous. We'll just call him MP. And when Friedrich realizes that Jeremy is dying dead, he sends MP, these are 12-year-old boys, sends them out in the middle of the night in West Virginia, there's no cell phone, to look for a payphone. And the boy takes him a while, but he finds a payphone and then calls for help. And the paramedics come, and also the police come, and also, Strange, the district attorney comes to the log cabin. The paramedics show up, and they see on Jeremy's chest clear bruises, abrasions. And Friedrich says, I've been doing CPR for 7 hours. So I checked with physicians about that, and they said, no, you can't do CPR for 7 hours. Those paramedics were never questioned by the police. That's one. Two, the case is closed literally that night by the district attorney, who makes the following decision. He brings in, out of retirement the next day, a retired medical examiner who, ignoring everything, says the boy died again, weak heart, tragic death, medical emergency, whatever. And that's it. And the boy's buried. Set two. That's it. The father, the parents are divorced because these guys like Friedrichs know who to groom. So Jeremy's parents are divorced. Mr. Bell doesn't buy this at all. He reaches out to a cousin, reaches out to a cousin, reaches out to a cousin. That's how Mr. Barber's brought into the case. So when he arrived in town, he was confronted with the boy had died this tragic death, but when he quickly realized that was simply 100% incorrect, and he understood instinctively that this was murder. And again, it took him 2 to 3 years to break the case. I mean, as I say, bequeathed to me the material, which was an extraordinary honor. But you are 100% right. Local law enforcement, acting at the behest of the district attorney, in plain English, shut it down within a day.
Mm-hmm. So what's your guess on motivations here? Again, I guess, protecting an institution?
I think in this case, with all due respect to Mr. Barber's theories, and I have enormous respect for Mr. Barber, I mean, there are no words to describe Mr. Barber. Protect the institution, protect the good name, and you don't want a banner headline. I mean, headline in the newspaper.
Yeah. So let's take a break. We come back. I want to talk about your recommendations. You have several in the book, and how, you know, how we break this cycle, I think Mr. Barber, when he bequeathed all of his research to you, and with the understanding that you're going to do your best to prevent future deaths, murders like the one Jeremy Bell suffered, right? So let's take a break. We'll come back with more with Amos Giora. The book is The Complicity of Silence, Confronting Ecosystems of Child Sexual Abuse in Schools. We'll also talk in the next segment about the Bystander Initiative. More following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. So we're speaking with University of Utah Law Professor Amos Giora. The latest book is The Complicity of Silence, Confronting Ecosystems of Child Sexual Abuse in Schools. And he uses as a kind of a central case in this book the murder of 12-year-old Jeremy Bell, who was killed at the hands of Edgar Friedrichs, a serial pedophile teacher and later principal, who taught for decades at Pennsylvania and West Virginia schools despite extensive complaints submitted to school administrators. He was only able to continue this with the help of enablers. So, Professor Giora, Edgar Friedrichs was convicted. He's serving a lifetime sentence. But that only happened because Dan Barber doggedly pursued this case, right? That wasn't the DA or the police in this case.
And, no, sir.
And
100% correct.
And Edgar Friedrichs was able to go decades without facing justice because of enablers. So, and this is just one case, right? You talked about the Michigan State case and many, many other cases. So how do we break this cycle?
For me, it's simple. We hold enablers accountable. And the only way to hold enablers personally accountable is to bring them before a court of law, and therefore the need to criminalize the act of enabling. Institutions, when they settle, when the lawsuits, civil lawsuits are filed, there's Michigan State paid $400 million, the University of Michigan paid $500,000, the Catholic Church paid who knows how much. But that's not paid. That doesn't impact the individuals. I mean, it's covered by insurance companies. So there's no impact on the individual who needs to be held accountable. And yes, with all due respect to people in your industry, in the media, the primary emphasis is on the perpetrator, which I well understand. Perpetrators of zero interest to me. And by the way, oftentimes of zero interest to the survivors, because they understand what I said to you earlier, that without the enabler, they never would have met the perpetrator, because the perpetrator was protected by the enabler. And so for me, if we really, really want to address this epidemic of sexual assault, so all of these issues that I discuss, if we're serious about this, then the way to do this is to indeed make the determined decision to hold the enablers criminally accountable, not civilly, because there again you have the insurance companies who pay out to the institute to cover the cost of the settlement, but to have the individual enabler held accountable. The only way to do that is to criminalize the act of enabling and the action of the actor. Otherwise, there will be no change.
So I believe you point out in the book that there are several states who have instituted criminal penalties for bystanders, including Utah,
correct.
Believe, right?
Correct.
Not all states, right? But some.
Correct.
How about enablers? Are there any nope. Laws in effect?
In the United States of America, no. The only country, because I've testified in, obviously here in the States, but I've also testified in Holland, the Netherlands, and in Australia, we had initial legislative success in the Netherlands, but there was a change in government, and you know as well as I do, when there's a change in government, legislation that had been, I mean, just the reality of politics. So it is an uphill fight, which I well understand, but that, at the end of the day, is exactly the purpose of the program that we've established here at the law school, the Bystander Initiative, which is to write books, articles, engage with distinguished individuals such as yourself, and with other groups, whether in the world or here in the United States, here in Utah, to, at the end of the day, convince the public, the media, legislators, and others of the need to criminalize. And that really is the purpose of this program that we've established here, the Bystander Initiative.
Tell me a little bit more about the Bystander Initiative. The part of this is you've got a Bystander Initiative Award named after your father, for example.
Indeed. Indeed. It's a wonderful story. My father, who was a professor at the University of Michigan, one of his students, who my father had been his mentor a few years ago, reached out to me after my father had died and said, your father was your father, and he was my mentor, this article, a traditional academic thing. And then we started talking, Professor Scoville and I, and one day Professor Scoville said, well, how do I help you? What do you need from me? And I said, frankly, money. And he indeed created this scholarship in my father's name. And then we've been I've been very grateful to other donors who have truly come forward and donated resources that has one purpose, and that enables to pay the team of researchers, of students who work with me. It's donor-driven, and the money, funds go to cover the money to pay for students who work with me. As you and I are speaking, as I'm looking at the whiteboard on my desk, there are two books or three books on progress, two or three articles, and then an additional research project. I mean, this is a major undertaking. I think to date there have been 18 or 19 students who've worked with me under the umbrella of the Bystander Initiative. And the donations, for which I'm eternally grateful that people are so gracious, in addition to Professor Scoville, other, for instance, Representative King and others, that enables me to direct this program and to have the remarkable students who are willing to work with me. The work is hard because the topic is hard, but I think they understand that there's a need to address the question of the enabler and to hold the enabler accountable. And that, at the end of the day, is the focus of this, by now, large undertaking here at the College of Law.
So much about this is laudable, and thank you for your work. I'm very struck by the courage of the survivors here. There's one who was reading about the Bystander Initiative, and you have a class called The Bystander, right? It's based on your studies of complicity in the Holocaust and sexual violence. One of those students was former ballet dancer who was sexually abused as a young dancer, nearly dropped the class because the subject matter was understandably triggering, but stuck it out and then became a Bystander Initiative research assistant. Just one of many, many stories. Many people you've interviewed, I'm sure, impressive to you as well.
It is overwhelming, and I don't like adjectives, but it is overwhelming how people have responded. I've been told that what this undertaking does is it gives a voice. This is not my phrase, Tom. Gives voice to the voiceless. Because I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that I'm one of the few, if not only, and we'll be very careful here, who is totally focused in his research on enablers and bystanders, primarily in sexual assaults, but not only in sexual assaults. See the new book on Israel and the Holocaust. And in terms of giving voice to the voiceless, not with respect to the perpetrator, but with respect to the enabler. And if a project like this gives, I'm sure this is the right word, legitimacy to their anger at those who protected the perpetrator and the institution, then that, from my perspective, gets me up. I woke up this morning, Tom, at 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the morning to work on this stuff, because this is real. The other day I received a handwritten letter. I obviously won't tell you from who or from where the person lives, that she had read about me, heard about me, and sharing just wanted to write a thank you for my work on this. She doesn't want anything other than to say thank you, beyond rewarding, which is full circle with the students, the donors, and the end goal of legislation. And in the meantime, writing, book after book, article after article, and the extraordinary work of my students.
Well, we'll leave it there out of time. Just to note that the book is Complicity of Silence, Confronting Ecosystems of Child Sexual Abuse in Schools. We'll have a link to that on our website, upr.org, with this episode. We'll also have a link to the information about the Bystander Initiative. And we've been talking with the University of Utah Law Professor Amos Chiora. Thank you so much.
An honor to be on the show, as always. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll go out, as we do on Wednesdays, with Beehive Archive. Thanks.
It's the Beehive Archive on Utah Public Radio. I'm Megan Van Frank. Today, Salt Lake City's urban sprawl and poor air quality are noteworthy, but the problem isn't exactly new. Public parks were once seen as an antidote to the bad effects of increasing urbanization, kind of like a little bit of the country in the city, if you will. Find out more after this.
I'm Jody Graham, Director of Utah Humanities. Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by Utah Humanities, with the generous support of the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation. We are proud to partner with community organizations to tell Utah stories and hope you will tune in each week for the Beehive Archive.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. By the end of the 19th century, rapid urban growth and industrial smoke in Salt Lake County threatened open natural spaces. Where farmland and rural areas in the Salt Lake Valley turned increasingly urban, the open natural spaces offered by public parks gave city residents some breathing room and a small taste of the countryside. One of the earliest and largest urban parks in Utah is Liberty Park, located along 7th East and 13th South in Salt Lake City. The park's original 5 acres once served as a grist mill and farm. When the city purchased the land from Brigham Young's estate in 1881, it was in the spirit of social reform. Following the example of New York City's Central Park, the design of Liberty Park was heavily influenced by the Victorian ideal of nature as an antidote for the effects of industrialization. Soon after the park was dedicated, the city hired a superintendent and worked with a landscape gardener to design the grounds. The early landscaping included recreational areas, open green spaces, and an oval ring road looping the perimeter. Several small paths allowed visitors to amble through the park, taking in their natural surroundings. At Liberty Park's opening celebration, one speaker remarked that sometimes the beautiful is as useful as the useful, perhaps more so. In the early 1900s, Liberty Park was at the center of an all-too-familiar controversy over clean air. Nearby smelter smoke threatened the park's foliage and the neighborhood's air quality. Shortly after Salt Lake City Mayor John Bransford identified smoke reduction as an urgent need, many of the smelters in the Central Valley closed. The desire to preserve natural oases in urbanizing areas was part of a larger movement to beautify cities and improve the moral character of urbanites. Today, Liberty Park still serves its original purpose. The park provides ample opportunity for residents to recreate or otherwise enjoy the natural environment. The grounds are now lined with mature trees that provide a sense of seclusion amidst an otherwise bustling urban area. Although Liberty Park has significantly changed over the course of the last century, it remains a valuable resource for Salt Lake City residents to get outside and play. Find sources and past episodes of the Beehive Archive at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of Utah Humanities, I'm Megan Van Frank.
On University at Albany Week, what happens when kids watch too much media at a young age? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the American Association of Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Sarah Domoff, assistant professor in the Department of Psychology in the College of Arts and Sciences, looks into this.
Media consumption among young children is on the rise. As this trend grows, understanding how early media use can impact a child's development, social and emotional outcomes, and behavioral patterns is key to preventing harmful habits with long-term effects. I recently collaborated on a study that examined problematic media use, what we call PMU, during early childhood. PMU is when media consumption starts interfering with day-to-day life, social interactions, or emotional regulation. Our longitudinal analysis focused on children 2.5 to 5.5 years old. Caregivers were asked to recall the frequency of their child's engagement with various types of screen media over the past month and report associated behaviors that could be considered problematic or addictive, such as loss of interest in other activities, preoccupation with media, social withdrawal, and sneaking media use. Our study found evidence of problematic media use among children as young as 2, with a tendency for PMU to increase as children got older. Factors like a child's initial emotional reactivity, levels of aggression, and even the amount of time they spend watching TV early on can predict the extent to which media use might become a problem later. Further, children who demonstrated higher levels of PMU were more likely to experience social and emotional issues 4 years later. Kids whose media use increased over time were more likely to develop aggressive behaviors, even if they weren't aggressive to begin with. This study underscores the importance of paying attention to how young children use media. By understanding and addressing problematic media use early on, we can support better social, emotional, and behavioral outcomes as kids grow up. Our findings also suggest that early intervention, like setting healthy media boundaries and helping kids develop better self-regulation, could make a big difference in preventing long-term issues.
That was Sarah Domoff of the University at Albany. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from AAC&U, Advancing Liberal Learning and Research for the Public Good.